This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Parhiskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of a grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every ear. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Here's a look at our top stories this hour. Unanimous condemnation from the UN Security Council over the killing of Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Akla and a call for an impartial investigation. Hamas urges the rapid formation of a unified Palestinian command to lead field battles against Israel. Also ahead, Russia planning to cut Finland's electricity supply as soon as Saturday, 2 days after the nation announces its bid to join NATO. Thank you for joining us. The United Nations Security Council has condemned the killing of Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Akla by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank. The 15-member UN body issued a unanimous condemnation on Friday. The Security Council called for an immediate, thorough, transparent, and impartial investigation into Abu Akla's killing. She was a journalist at the Arabic language channel of the Qatar-based Al Jazeera TV network. Abu Akla, 51 years old, was fatally shot while covering an Israeli army raid in the city of Jenin on Wednesday. She was wearing a press vest and standing with other journalists when targeted. The killing sparked an international outcry, with calls growing for Israel to be held accountable for the murder of the veteran reporter. Paul Lurdy is a Free Palestine Movement activist that says the UN Security Council's call for a probe is just face saver for Israel, as its impartiality will be in question without a trusted panel.
The Security Council has asked for an impartial investigation, but that they haven't said who's going to do this investigation, and it won't be impartial unless we have people from various opinions and who are trusted. And I can't imagine that the Security Council will provide a panel. An investigation panel that is actually impartial and will provide anything more than a slap on the wrist for Israel. They may say it appears that, or something. It'll be inconsequential. It's meaningless. It's a face saver for Israel and the United States. The rest of the world won't be able to trust it. Is someone from South Africa going to be there? Is someone from Venezuela going to be there? I don't think so.
Thousands of Palestinians have held a funeral for veteran journalist Shirin Abu Akleh, who was killed by Israeli forces. Abu Akleh was laid to rest in a cemetery in occupied East Al-Quds. Tensions simmered at the beginning of her funeral. Israeli forces attacked mourners trying to carry Abu Akleh's casket from a hospital to her funeral service in a church. The Palestinian Red Crescent says at least 33 people were injured in Israeli attacks. She was killed by regime forces while reporting on a raid by troops in Jenin. Earlier, nearly a dozen Palestinians were injured after Israeli forces attacked Palestinians in the Jenin refugee camp. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas denounced the raid, saying Jenin will continue its resistance against the occupying regime. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas is calling for the quick formation of a single unified command to lead field battles with the Israeli regime. The head of the political bureau of Hamas, Ismail Haniyeh, is calling on the Palestinian Authority to stop security cooperation with Israel. Haniyeh says the Palestinian Authority should focus on a comprehensive resistance plan to counter the regime. He says this needs a firm and strategic decision against Israel as Palestinians confront the regime on all levels. The senior Hamas official also says the Palestinian Authority should abolish the Oslo Accords, in which it recognized the existence of Israel. His comments come on the eve of the anniversary of formation of Israel on Palestinian lands, which Palestinians mark as Nakba, or Day of Disaster. The military wing of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad says it has killed an Israeli trooper during an ambush on regime forces in the occupied West Bank. The Al-Quds Brigade say several Israeli forces were also injured in the attack near Jenin, north of the occupied West Bank. The operation was staged after a fresh Israeli raid on the outskirts of Jenin refugee camp. During the raid, regime forces arrested a member of Al-Quds Brigade. Jenin has been a target of the Israeli military crackdown in the occupied West Bank over the past weeks. The regime has stepped up its raids and arrests across the occupied West Bank after a series of Palestinian attacks in the occupied territories killed over a dozen Israelis. The Secretary General of Lebanon's resistance movement, Hezbollah, has strongly condemned the Israeli brutal killing of Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Akleh. Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said Abu Akleh had for years been a witness to Israeli crimes against the Palestinian people. He said Arab regimes who rush to normalize relations with the Zionist entity will be ashamed of it. Nasrallah praised Iran and Syria for providing all-out support to the resistance movement. During his speech at an election campaign rally in Bekaa Valley, Nasrallah said enemies want the people of the valley to abandon resistance. The Hezbollah leader called on the Lebanese nation to vote for candidates who enjoy expertise and experience.
And I do believe that you are those who did not stop at giving your own lives or your blood or your bodies or your homes or your money or every sort of sacrifice. It will not be difficult for you to go all together, all of you, and I repeat all of you, to the ballot boxes, to give this voice, to give your vote and protect these arms, and to face and send a message to all those conspiring against your resistance, conspiring against your security, conspiring against your presence and your existence.
The Secretary General of Lebanon's resistance movement commended the Lebanese people for the sacrifices they made to help the resistance front. He also urged cooperation among all political factions to resolve problems together. Elsewhere in his remarks, Nasrallah slammed those in Lebanon who think arms of resistance are the root cause of all problems. He denounced those calling for Hezbollah to disarm and condemned candidates who are seeking to sow discord in Lebanon. The Hezbollah leader said the U.S. government is seeking to humiliate the Lebanese people through whatever means available. Protesters gathered in front of the state broadcaster, the BBC, in London to hold a vigil condemning the killing of Al Jazeera journalist Shirin Abu Akleh. Palestinian leaders say they will refer the death of the respected reporter to the International Criminal Court. Amina Taylor reports.
She's been called the martyr of the free world, executed by an Israeli sniper while simply out doing her job. The outrage at Shireen's killing has once again highlighted the risk journalists and observers who report on the Palestinian conflict face. Dozens have been deliberately targeted and killed by Israel in the past decade.
She's been targeted, sadly, and this can only be described as an act of assassination, a deliberate killing of somebody who's innocent, who's just trying to tell the truth and what's happening in Palestine, violations of human rights, violations of the peace agreements.
Despite eyewitness accounts and footage emerging from the scene, there's a growing sense of anger and frustration that mainstream media organizations like the BBC continue to report the killing of this well-respected journalist as anything other than intentional. Those attending the vigil in honor of Shireen were united in their condemnation and their grief.
She was killed in cold blood. And we're still really processing that this had just happened against a woman that formed part of our consciousness about what is going around us and the horrific realities that we've lived. And for us, especially like as a kid growing through the second intifada in Jabalia refugee camp in Gaza, we looked up to her.
Devastated, sad, really, because Shireen was not just a brilliant journalist. She was a beloved friend of mine, of my family. So it's a personal loss. It's a national loss. And it's a global loss, as you see around you. Those who killed her did not just kill the body of Shireen. They killed the idea of Shireen, the spirit of Shireen, the insistence on her to report the truth. They wanted to kill the truth. But like in her life, even in her tragic murder, she has conveyed the message so loudly to everybody that this occupier is criminal.
Campaigners are urging their respective governments not to let Israel get away with this crime and hold those responsible for the execution of a journalist simply exposing inconvenient truths about the Israeli occupation. Amina Taylor, London.
Russia will soon cut power deliveries to Finland due to a lack of payment. A Finnish subsidiary of Russian energy provider Interrao says electricity imports from Russia are set to stop on May the 14th. That's due to the Scandinavian country's inability to make payments for the deliveries. Finland's transmission grid operator says the situation will pose no threat to the adequacy of electricity as Russia's imports only make up 10% of the country's total consumption. Fingrid says it will instead increase power supplies from Sweden and ramp up domestic production to compensate for the loss. This comes after Finland's leaders said the country must apply to join NATO without delay. Moscow has repeatedly warned Helsinki against joining the alliance.
NATO critics say the alliance's expansion is what led to the war in Ukraine, and now moves are afoot to provoke Moscow even further. It looks almost certain that Finland, and most probably Sweden, are to join NATO. Via video link, senior Helsinki officials set out their case to the European Parliament on Thursday as to why Finland would fit right in.
Finland has many high-end capabilities, including a fighter jet fleet of F-80s, gradually to be replaced by recently ordered 64 F-35 jet fighters.
Sweden's Malin Björk asked, what's the rush given that her country and Finland have said they don't feel under immediate threat? However, it seems most EU lawmakers are supportive.
We think that it is not only defining for Finnish security, but it's only an important step in European history.
Finland's border with Russia stretches for 1,300 kilometres. Membership would mean NATO's land border with the Federation would more than double. The Kremlin has warned there will be military retaliation if the plan goes ahead. Experts aren't ruling out the possibility of World War III.
This creates a major problem because when you change the architecture of security, of course, you create waves of reaction and perceived threats, which is the case for Russia now.
The US and its European allies are spending enormous amounts of money on arming Ukraine. One EU lawmaker criticized this during Thursday's proceedings.
We have a very powerful arms industry in the European Union, and many nations rely on arms exports. We should be doing all we can to prevent conflicts escalating instead.
Analysts say it could take up to a year for Finland to fully join NATO, but in the meantime, it will become a de facto member. The question is, in the event of escalation, will it be viewed as protected or as a target? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The Northern Irish society has been bitterly divided along religious and sectarian lines since its inception, but it seems that the Sinn Féin victory in the country's recent parliamentary elections could change that. From Belfast, Saeed Pourreza has sent us this report.
Some say the recent election changes everything. Others say it doesn't. But it has changed a century of unionist political dominance.
The state was founded on the basis of a gerrymandered sectarian headcount, where it was believed there would be a permanent and perpetual unionist majority. Nationalists and Republicans were never intended or expected to get the top political job here.
The election has complicated Northern Ireland's existing problems. Sinn Féin nationalists' victory, a step towards a future united Ireland, a blow to the unionists, with the Democratic Unionists Party threatening to boycott the Stormont Assembly over a post-Brexit sea border for trade that they say undermines Northern Ireland's position in the United Kingdom.
Among the things that remain to be changed, this reminder of the decades-old sectarian divide, a wall separating communities as it has done through decades of troubles and peace. We tried to speak to people on the unionist side of it, to no avail. But real change seems happening in the center. The Alliance Party has doubled its vote share among those who want to increase awareness. Cross-community efforts like those here may speak of a younger generation's desire to understand each other, regardless of which side they're on.
They ever say they're afraid with other people, but when you get to know the people from the other side, like Protestants and all, they're actually dead on, and it's good to be being friends with them, and just to do a lot of things.
So with like the community centre, like Clonard, we, all of us probably, including me, we probably wouldn't have been able to like talk to people from the other side, like Protestants.
And this is not the only centre forging such ties, and they're all moving in the same direction.
So the purpose of this is trying to normalise interactions between both communities, to show young people that the culture and identity of those people based on the other side of the wall is no threat to their own culture and identity. And then a copper fastens their sense of culture, identity and space that makes it harder to feel threatened by others.
But while those threats remain, it is clear that there is a middle ground growing, thanks to these nascent cross-community ties. Saeed Pourreza, Belfast, Northern Ireland.
North Korea records more deaths from COVID as it battles its first ever outbreak since the pandemic began. Local media on Saturday reported 21 more deaths and about 174,400 new cases for a day earlier. North Korea's total COVID deaths are now 27. Its total cases are above 524,400. The country confirmed its first COVID cases in the capital of Pyongyang on Thursday. The media said the patients had tested positive for Omicron, including one person who died. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un says the outbreak has put the country in a great turmoil. Lockdowns are now in place nationwide to slow the spread of the disease. That does it for this edition of World News.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
On Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite, words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord and Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee, and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
In the limelight. Condemnations have been pouring in from different quarters on the cold-blooded murder of the Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Akleh by Israeli regime forces in the occupied West Bank on Wednesday, 11th of May. We now present you an article written by Sayed Zafar Mahdi, a Tehran-based journalist, editor, political commentator and author. The piece is titled Shirin Abu Akleh's Gory Murder by Israel and Western Media's Skullduggery. A veteran Palestinian journalist, Shirin Abu Akleh, was murdered in cold blood early on Wednesday, 11th of May, while covering an Israeli military raid in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. To get this straight, without beating around the bush and without resorting to distortion of facts, Abu Akleh wasn't killed. She was murdered. She was shot in the face despite sporting a vest with "Press" written in capital letters on it. it was a premeditated murder. It certainly was not a case of mistaken identity either. One can clearly tell the difference between an unarmed journalist and an armed fighter, between a camera and a Kalashnikov. Abu Aguila was not carrying arms or explosives that would potentially unnerve her killers. She was busy doing her job, which was to report the truth and unmask the tyrants, usurpers and aggressors. The long-time Al Jazeera Arabic journalist, who shot to fame while covering the second intifada between 2000 and 2005, was along with a group of local journalists reporting on an Israeli raid when the trigger-happy raiders went berserk. They clearly knew their target. It was a cowardly murder, a dastardly crime, an abhorrent abuse of power. It won't be an exaggeration to say that the 51-year-old Palestinian reporter was mowed down for exposing the apartheid regime's horrendous crimes in the occupied territories for the past 25 years. She had been rightly hailed as the voice of Palestinians in their long-standing struggle for the liberation of their occupied homeland and the freedom of their loved ones languishing in the dark dungeons of the Israeli regime. Quite brazenly, but unsurprisingly, the Western military-industrial media complex can't see this broad daylight transgression the way it is. They are busy putting a spin on it to absolve the child-murdering regime in Tel Aviv of its horrendous crimes despite growing outrage across the world. The New York Times, which claims to be a champion of free speech in an obnoxious editorial decision, tried hard to trivialize the magnitude of the tragedy. The newspaper headline on Wednesday, 11th of May, beamed, "Shirin Abu Aguila, Palestinian journalist, dies, age 51. As if the slain journalist had passed away peacefully in her sleep, as if no one murdered her in cold blood, as if nothing had happened. The Associated Press said the Palestinian journalist was killed by gunfire, without specifying the origin of the fire. The headline seemed to suggest that it was a stray bullet that smashed Abu Aguila's face while she was accidentally trapped in the crossfire. Nothing can be further from the truth. Western media, through these misleading headlines and distorted reportage, have once again exhibited its hard-to-miss pro-Israel tilt as if competing for the attention of murder masterminds in Tel Aviv. In an attempt to give a clean sheet to killers, big media flashed headlines such as Abu Aguila was killed during Israeli raid in the West Bank, the BBC. Killed while reporting on an Israeli raid, NPT. Killed while covering an Israeli military operation, CNN. No one said who killed her and why. The problem here is when reporting on Israeli war crimes in the occupied Palestinian territories, Western media simply assumes that balance means giving equal weight to both sides, without realizing one is an oppressor and the other is the oppressed. There can be no match. These headlines are classic examples of media misrepresentation, obfuscation, spin doctoring, and bizarre distortion of facts to fit a particular narrative. In this case, the narrative peddled by the Zionist regime and their apologists. Far from accepting responsibility, they have been hell-bent on pushing the blame on poor, hapless victims. The British newspaper The Guardian said Israel has been accused of murdering the Al Jazeera journalist while parroting the regime's baseless claims that the journalist may have been hit by Palestinian fire. Some, like the right-leaning Fox News channel, went a step further, saying the Al Jazeera journalist died following disputed incident in the occupied West Bank, not too different from the version pushed by the New York Times. There was no dispute, no clashes, and no one actually died. It was a brutal, diabolic murder of a Palestinian journalist by the Israeli military. Abu Aghila's murder is not an isolated case, though. According to the Palestinian Journalist Syndicate, PSJ, a body formed by journalists based in the city of Al-Quds, at least 46 journalists have been murdered since 2000 by the occupying forces, and absolutely no one has been held to account. Reporters Without Borders say at least 144 Palestinian journalists have been wounded by Israeli forces in the occupied Gaza Strip, in the occupied West Bank and the city of Al-Quds since 2018. Never has the Western media acknowledged Israel's war crimes in the occupied territories, let alone condemn them, even when journalists have been at the receiving end of the violence. On the contrary, it has sought to portray Palestinians as aggressors, misreporting Israel's naked aggression in Gaza as clashes or flare-ups of violence. The lives of Palestinians don't matter at all to Western journalists, including Palestinian journalists who brave enormous risks to report the truth. When Israeli airstrikes destroyed a media tower in the besieged Gaza Strip in May of 2021, there was a deafening silence from Western media outlets. In April of 2022, the Palestinian Journalist Syndicate, PJS, and other media bodies filed a formal complaint with the International Criminal Court, the ICC, against Israel's systematic targeting of journalists. Interestingly, the blatant double standards on the Palestinian issue are also exemplified by style guides used in big Western media organizations, which essentially prohibit the use of the word Palestine. For example, the 55th edition of the Associated Press style book, which is used widely in the West, states that words such as Palestine and Palestinians should be used in the context of Palestine's activities in international bodies to which it has been admitted. But words such as Palestine or State of Palestine not be used in other situations, since it is not a fully independent, unified state. This deliberate attempt by editors to apply style guide rules for neutral coverage without considering nuances of the issue is an utter disservice to both journalism and media practitioners in Palestine. It's time to call out the blatant hypocrisy of Western media, because Shirin Abu Aghila isn't the first one and most probably won't be the last one. Meanwhile, condemnations have been pouring in from different quarters on the cold-blooded murder of a Palestinian journalist by the Israeli regime forces in the occupied West Bank on Wednesday. The Islamic Republic of Iran, together with the resistance groups from Palestine and Lebanon, strongly condemned the murder of the Al Jazeera journalist, calling it a crime and an attack targeting the truth. Iran's Foreign Ministry spokesman, Saeed Khatibzadeh, denounced the fatal attack and commiserated with her family, the Qatar-based channel, and journalists committed to the Palestinian cause. Khatibzadeh said, "The criminal act is clear proof of the Zionist regime's utter disregard for the role of the press, the role of the media and journalists, and the position they hold to inform public opinion." The Lebanese Islamic resistance movement Hezbollah also strongly condemned Abu Aghila's assassination, stressing that the Israeli regime was trying to muzzle the voice of journalists to cover his crimes. It urged media organizations, the United Nations and human rights groups to denounce the Israeli regime in international forums and prevent the regime's acts of aggression against Palestinian journalists. Hazem Qasem, a spokesman for the Gaza-based Palestinian Hamas resistance movement, said Shirin Abu Aghila's assassination added to Israel's long list of crimes, especially against Palestinian journalists. Anthony Bellinger, the secretary of the International Federation of Journalists, termed Abu Aghila's killing as a deliberate, systematic targeting of a journalist. Anthony Bellinger said in a statement, "Yet again, journalists wearing press vests clearly identified were targeted by Israeli snipers." We will seek to add this case to the International Criminal Court complaint submitted by the IFJ detailing such systematic targeting. The Palestinian Journalist Syndicate also denounced Abu Aqila's martyrdom as a clear assassination perpetrated by the Israeli occupation army. The Palestinian Journalist Syndicate held the Israeli occupation forces fully responsible for this heinous crime against press freedom, particularly after World Press Freedom Day, marked on 8th of May.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en. Free territory.
Part 2.
During my childhood, the conquest of desert was a dream that took me on a vacation to Patagonia. 200 kilometers on a straight line through the province of La Pampa. Almost 150 years have passed since the Argentine Republic launched an offensive to expand its borders and dispose the indigenous people of their ancestral lands in the south part of the country. The conquest of the desert was not a trip. It was a campaign of extermination carried out by its two main protagonists, Julio Argentino Roca and Remington Rifles, who came from the United States. Julio Argentino Roca was a 35-year-old young general with a brilliant military career. In 1878, he was Minister of War and Navy. He was the intellectual and material author of the first genocide in the history of Argentina, While he was presenting his plans for the desert campaign to the assembly, he said, "We have 6,000 soldiers who are armed with the latest modern military inventions in order to fight against the 2,000 Indians who have no defense other than dispersion and no weapons other than the primitive spear." One of the most powerful indigenous chiefs of Patagonia was Modesto Encalao, a man who did not have a hostile policy towards the government of Argentina. He was deprived of his land, sent to prison, and later he was transferred to Buenos Aires. He was condemned to slavery in the last days of his life in the underground Museum of Natural Sciences of La Plata. Encalao was tormented and died far from his homeland. He spent long hours looking at the remains of his wife and loved ones that were exhibited by Perito Moreno as anthropological pieces in the museum. Those who saw him in the last days of his life described him as a ghost. The military soldiers had also stolen his children. Later, they gave the children to the families of the generals to work as their servants. Some reports point out that before his death, he ripped off the white man's clothes. Encalao had resisted declaring himself as Argentinian. His outraged body also remained as a museum piece for more than 100 years. At the beginning of the 21st century, many children from Patagonia wrote letters to the authorities of the La Plata Museum to ask them to return his remains to the original territory. Emmanuel Roman, a 10-year-old boy, wrote a letter, "I'm asking you to return the body parts of the aboriginals to their families. What they did to them were inhumane, removing the hair, brain, and body parts of Chief Encalao. I do not want the remains to be exhibited in a museum. He was a person like you and I. Sincerely yours." His body parts have been resting in Valladateca region since 2014, but I felt that he was still a prisoner. Other sources show that in reality their camps were not in that valley, but on the shores of Nahuel Huapi Lake. Encalao's portrait that is marked by the failure of people functions as a time machine that reminds indignation and impotence. I hope when he took his last breath in those torture halls in La Plata, he saw images of his territory, a free territory. Today, the Mapuche people live on the fringe of the Patagonian cities and in hundreds of rural communities that record each particular reality. Since the conquest of desert, this indigenous ethnic group has struggled to recover the territories stolen by the state in Argentina, or Pueblo Mapu. As we know the original language, we understand that most of the complaints were made in the provinces of Neuquén, Rio Negro, and Chubut. Before the formation of the states at the beginning of the 19th century, these regions were inhabited by Mapuches, Tehuelches, and other small villages. The Neuquén community of Paisil Antirriao took the first steps to move towards understanding the problems of the land with its protagonists. In 1902, the Argentine state granted the possession of 625 hectares to Lunco Ignacio Antirriao on the banks of the Nahuel Huapi and Corrientoso lakes, where Villa La Angostura is currently located. Villa La Angostura is an exclusive tourist center where President Mauricio Macri usually goes there for his vacations. More than 100 years ago, the villa did not exist, and the Argentine state had to consolidate its sovereignty in the place, which is why they officially recognized the ownership of land to those who lived in the place ancestrally. A wooden statue reminds us of Lunco Antirriao, the person who helped the Argentinians during the border demarcation. By consolidating the villa as a touristic paradise, the state began to usurp territory until it occupied 500 out of the 625 of the community's hectares. In 2004, Emmanuel Ginobili, NBA world star, bought 11 hectares inside of community land. Rosa was living here until the millionaire player claimed for the seizure of the territory.
Ginobili fakes, lost it, gets it back, flips it up and flips it in! Exclamation point from Manu Ginobili!
The claim was rejected, but Rosa experienced several eviction attempts. In 1878, the president of Argentina, Nicolas Avellaneda, stated, "Our self-respect as a virile people obliges us to put down as soon as possible, by reason or by force, this handful of savages who destroy our wealth and prevent us from definitely occupying, in the name of law, progress, and our own security, the richest and most fertile lands of the Republic." Conflicts over lands acquire more dramatic cast in 39 kilometers south of Bariloche, the tourist epicenter of Patagonia. A Mapuche group from the suburbs of the city recovered a property that is claimed by national parks. In November 25, 2017, state security forces entered the territory and killed Rafael Noel. The government accused the young people of having used firearms and said that they belonged to RAM, the Mapuche Ancestral Resistance. It is considered as an organization that the executive relates it to guerrilla and terrorist activities. No firearms were seized during the operation. On August 1, 2017, another state operation killed Santiago Maldonado in a recovered territory in Cushman, Chubut province. The case seriously affected the image of the national government, as the young man's body remained missing for 78 days. Thank you. Minister Bullrich, belongs to an oligarchic family that benefited directly from the desert campaign. Likewise, Esteban Bullrich, who claimed the conquest as the Minister of Education. According to most accounts, Maldonado had entered the Chubut River with the intention of crossing it in an attempt to prevent the entrance of forces of repression. 5 days before the legislative elections, his body was found floating during a rake of the river. Cushaman's Polaf, in resistance, was recovered from the Benetton company by a group that belongs to Lonco Facundo Jones Huala, syndicated as RAM leader. In January of that same year, his community had suffered a violent eviction attempt. Not all police officers hesitated to confront their ethnic contradictions. During the judicial hearings of Jones Huala's group, two agents are murmuring, and finally they recognize each other as Mapuche. But they affirm that these young people are an embarrassment and question their original membership. Benetton owns 900,000 hectares acquired in a transaction in 1991. During the previous 100 years, an English company registered in Argentina under the name Argentine Southern Land Company had the control of the land. In 1890, just after the end of the Desert Campaign, then-President Miguel Juarez Celman ceded those 900,000 hectares by decree as the Argentine state wished to populate Patagonia with white Europeans. The land was given away free of charge, without paying a single peso, just due to the commitment to bring in settlers and make investments. The vice president, Carlos Pellegrini, criticized this decision, and Juarez Celman replied in a letter that it was preferable to create an Ireland in Patagonia, to which it was submitted by the negligence of the Tehuelche. Juarez Celman was Roca's brother-in-law. Santiago Maldonado lost his life and disappeared after an action of state repression here in this area. There isn't a centralized government in the structure of Mapuche organization. In historical terms, this culture has given them a great power of military resistance. The Spanish conquistadors could vanish Mayas and Incas, but they couldn't do the same thing to the Mapuche nation. So they had to sign peace treaties recognizing the existence of this nation. As a counterpart, this worldview has prevented processes of broader unity. For centuries, different Mapuche camps have fought among themselves and did not come to an agreement for many times to confront the white man or Huinca. But the conquistadors took the most advantage of this opportunity. The arrival of Spaniards, Argentinians, and Chileans unleashed a series of highly complex social and political processes within this original society. Today, you can easily see the divisions and the lack of a major force that could derive from a process of unity. The Mapuche world has been changed and the miscegenation has been advanced. Those who belittle indigenous people pretend to undermine the legitimacy of their claims under the argument of skin color. Fernando Nahuel Pan exemplifies the dichotomy between identity and miscegenation. Maura Mihan recovered the territory that was in control of the police in the province of Chubut.
In the limelight.
As the West implements draconian sanctions against Russia, including the banning of the Russian news outlets RT and Sputnik from YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, and TikTok, as well as search engine results, social media censorship of political messaging about the Palestinian liberation struggle continues. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Omar Zahza, writer. This article is published under the heading, Social Media Giants Repress Palestinian Content. Here's the story. Silicon Valley is solidly entrenching itself as a devoted enemy of political dissent. As the West implements draconian sanctions against Russia, including the banning of the Russian news outlets RT and Sputnik from YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, and TikTok, as well as search engine results, social media censorship of political messaging about the Palestinian liberation struggle continues. On March 8, Instagram, owned by Facebook's Meta Platforms, deleted the main account of the organization Within Our Lifetime, or WOL, a New York City-based Palestinian community organization. The social media account was removed over a post that highlighted revolutionary Palestinian women in commemoration of International Women's Day. WOL explained that their account was suspended after years of online censorship and shadow banning. Shadow banning is the practice of restricting social media content that is not noticeable to the user. While companies like Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube once styled themselves protectors of free speech given the highly publicized use of their platforms, their actions over the following years have proved otherwise. As the Electronic Frontier Foundation noted in 2020, rampant censorship on social media is targeted against the very same regions these platforms initially used to promote their ostensible values of free speech. When pressed in the past, social media companies provided vague responses that only focused on technical issues and did not adequately explain the high rate and diverse types of censorship documented by rights advocates, according to the Palestinian digital rights group Hamle. The targeting of WOL's Instagram account shows that we need to whitewash our history as an organization in order to survive on social media. These actions show there is a limit to how much history, culture, and politics you're allowed to express, WOL chair Nardin Keswani told the Electronic Entawasa.
Keswani explained that the post initially received a disciplinary action called a strike from Instagram, which she said was common. Historically, she explained, Instagram would strike WOL posts with no clear pattern. The company even flagged a January post about a Palestinian prisoner, Hesham Abu Hawash, being infected with COVID-19 while in the Zionist regime hospital. Why should we assume that a post about a Palestinian prisoner getting COVID is going to get a strike? Keswani said. Keswani explained that the Women's Day post not only received a strike, but Instagram also sent a warning that the entire WOL account could be deleted permanently. Following this warning, WOL organizers found themselves unable to access the account. They launched a social media campaign to pressure Instagram to restore the account, and on March 12th, received an email from Instagram saying only that the account had been disabled by mistake and it would be restored. WOL stated, while the restoration of our main account following a massive outpouring of support from our comrades and supporters around the world marks a victory, we know that Instagram continues to uphold anti-Palestinian racism and actively works directly with our oppressors to silence us. But activists noted that Instagram's lack of transparency and seemingly arbitrary punitive measures indicate that the platform remains an embattled site for liberation-focused political messaging about Palestine. A member of the grassroots organization Palestinian Youth Movement, who asked to remain anonymous, told the Electronic Intifada that the group has had its social media activity heavily challenged since at least 2018, when Facebook began disappearing their posts about protest for the 70th anniversary of the Nakba. The PYM member explained, "We wouldn't have the option to invite people to the protest, and we continued receiving messages saying that our page was not being recommended to people." The digital repression escalated in May 2020.